Yes, my name is Rachel Craig. I was born and raised here in Kotzebue. I've worked with the elders since 1975. At that time, I had a summer job with NANA as researcher for the land selection on 14H. Locating all the old cemetery sites and historical places. And we realized at the time that there was so much traditional knowledge that our elders had that our generation didn't know about. And each time I came back, I told John Schaefer about it. And we got concerned that with each passing away of our elders, that so much of that information was leaving us. And in a short time, we wouldn't have any knowledgeable people to pass on that information to us. So we hit upon a elders conference concept at the time, and initially, I worked with Louise Ober, who was working for Manilak at the time, and when I left, she brought the proposal to John, and he rewrote it and eventually got it funded by the American Bicentennial Commission, which started our first Elders Conference in 1976. Our celebration that year was that we were looking back into our own cultural heritage to plan for our own future. And on recommendation of the elders, we had five other elders conferences, and this is where all the elders conferences that you ever hear about started. They've had some in Nome area, in Southeast Alaska, in Bristol Bay area, and now they've even had one at Canada, you know, in connection with the ICC. But fortunately for me, I was raised by my grandparents, and I learned to speak Inupiaq. I mean, I don't remember when I didn't understand Inupiaq, you know, it was spoken at home as I was growing up, and I've always understood it. I didn't speak it as well, I've had to work at that part, but because of my language skills, I've been able to work with the elders and got to know them well, and which people are knowledgeable about what area, you know, in our culture. So that has been my work with the elders in the last few years.
You were serving as chairman of the Traditional Native Arts Committee of the Alaska State Council on the Arts when Lena Sowers was chosen as one of four Native artists whose life and work are being documented as part of this project, the Artist Behind the Work series. Mm-hmm. How did the committee select the artists? I mean, what kind of people were they looking for, and then how did you choose Lena?
Well, see, I had been with the council for a couple of years, and I noticed that the people that they were choosing in times past were also Native people who worked at preserving their own culture, who were experts in certain areas of their culture. And I thought to myself, gee whiz, we have some people in our own area that are experts as well, and nobody ever hears about them, you know? So I got my typewriter busy and filled up a letter to the council recommending Lena Sowers, and because she's so expert in any kind of clothing, but mainly we see the fancy parties that she's made. And more than half of all of the girls that are in for our Miss Arctic Circle pageant here usually wear parkies that are made by Lena Sowers. And I thought, gee, in addition to her expertise in that area, she's also one of our resource people in our region. Her knowledge extends way back because she grew up before the white people ever came and has lived through the contact period and the transition period to today when we're trying to teach our own culture to our young people, you know. And she's been very supportive and helpful all along the way in all of our eldest conferences and whenever I need help. And there have been times when she's taken me aside and without my solicitation just encouraged me to continue what I'm doing, that it is good work, that it's good for all of us, not only the young people, but also for them, you know. That it gives them an opportunity to make a contribution for the future education of their children, their grandchildren, and all their posterity after that, you know. They really feel it's important that all of us know our own cultural heritage. I know it's really been important to me. It's made me feel like a complete person. I know who I am from way back, you know, and what we're doing today and for the future. It kind of ties things together, and I think if all of our kids could feel this same thing, it makes them feel like a complete person, you know, knowing their own background and having a purpose in life today and what to do tomorrow and, you know, and how to help the young people along. And it's good. It's good work.
So when you chose Lena as a person to represent the area, it wasn't just because she of her skill in making parkies, but also because of her importance to the community.
Yeah, I felt that she represented us in the traditional sense. We have other people who can also make parkas, and Lena has shown some of them, but. Even the elders look to her in an elders conference. like after all the younger ones have given excuse me, their input, then they depend on her to fill in the holes, you know, you might say, because they feel that she knows the culture so well and has lived so long, and her memory is good, that they really look up to her and the things that she says, you know. And she speaks her mind. She speaks her mind. And they respect her.
You mentioned that she's probably most well known outside the region for her fancy parkies or making dress parkies.
Mm-hmm.
What is it that makes a parkie a fancy parkie, or you know, is there a special fur or a design?
There are parkies and there are parkies. Mm-hmm. Like a rose is a rose is a rose, you know. A parka is a parka is a parka. There are different styles of parkas that you make. There are just a plain parka that you make, you know, and it's quite functional and it's warm. But it also has style, like the ones that they made out of caribou skins, the fawn skins and the reindeer skins. If you take a look at pictures, you will see that they have this, usually if it's dark skin, they have white for this part here, and it looks sort of like walrus tusks right down the front here, you know? Well, that shapes the head part and makes the size of the head to fit the shoulders and the body, and so that when you're turning around, etc., then the seams don't rip, you know, it's not tight, and it just fits beautifully. And the same way with the armholes and everything, they're cut in such a way and sewn that it gives you freedom of movement. And and those are the plain ones, the functional ones, and the straight ones are usually what they call the men's style, because the women's styles were the curved bottom, what they call the ipnalik, like a mountain, they say, you know, the literal translation. That was the female style. And usually the women wore long mukluks with them in the winter time, and the mukluks were way up to the hips, and they were trimmed with wolverine, etc. You know, so that when the parka opens on the side here, then they would also see that beautiful wolverine fur trimming. So. They were designed for beauty as well as for warmth and function. They didn't just slap some pieces of skin together. They designed them in such a way that they fit the body well without inhibiting your movement, you know, and at the same time, the cut was such a way that it there was beauty in it, and so the finished garment was beautiful. It was warm, it was beautiful, and it fit well. And so this is what they look at when we're having a fashion show. You know, there's beautiful fabrics now, etc. But if the calico parka hangs too far this way, you know, and the shoulders are too droopy and bunched up here, you know, they know that person doesn't really know how to cut a calico parka, even though the material is beautiful. They see that it hangs, that it fits well, you know, and that it hangs the way it's supposed to. And so, those were the everyday clothing. Now the fancy ones, where they have the trimming right on the shoulders here, and right down the front, and right down the back, those were for dress-up times. They didn't wear those every day. Those were worn for special occasions, like when they had certain ceremonies or certain gatherings, and when they traveled too, you know, to keep warm. But they were not an everyday garment. And in the olden days, the folks said not everybody had beautiful clothing. It was just people who could afford it, you know, because life in those days was not like today. They marvel at what we have today. They say, nobody goes hungry, the government looks after them, and there are stores. People don't really have to gather food because there's the stores, you know, and everything. But in their day, it wasn't like that. There were no stores. They traded with other people, but they had to do all their fishing first, all their seal hunting, making, putting food away, picking berries and greens, everything. They had to gather their own food, and then they traded their surplus with other people. And in that way, they rounded out their economy, you know, trading with people. Like, I was just reading recently by one group that talked about trading pottery with the Buckland people. And they were known for making beautiful pottery because there was clay over there that they could use. And like the Kobuk people were well known for trading their birch bark baskets, you know, because of the birch bark that they had up there, in addition to their dry fish and furs. And along the coast here, it was seal skins and seal oil. Everybody had to have seal oil, like the Selwyk people and the Kobuk people would trade for seal oil. And then from there, some of the Indians from the other side would come over and trade with them for that seal oil, you know. That was a precious commodity. And some of the materials that they used, like I mentioned, the little black strips that they have in the trimming, that's made out of fish skin. And Lena said she's tried dyeing the skins before. But after a while, if it rains on them or whatever, the dye runs, you know, or whatever, and then it's no longer the dark skin. She said what she uses is she removes the scales from the skin, and then she uses charcoal, and then just rubs that skin with charcoal, rubs it and rubs it and rubs it. And keep cleaning it and rub it and rub it and rub it, you know. And she said that's the only thing she's found that really retains its blackness if you rub a seal skin, a fish skin, after you remove the scales and mark it up, paint it with charcoal.
How about the tassels and trimmings along the back? What are those usually on?
The tassels are usually wolverine, out of the belly part of the wolverine. They always had little bits of red that you sewed on white skins for trimming on the hood. And that's what they call kogrisik, when they sew the little red pieces. And in those days, it usually was little pieces of leather that had been dyed with alder bark. And they had she said they had a thumb guard made out of ivory. And they would sew these in, and then they would cut those little pieces on their thumb guard, you know, with an ulu. Because, and it was really fine work. They had to really be careful because it was cut very small, and it had to be sewn just right. To give it uniformity and not the sloppiness. So, and they did the same kind of work on the men's fancy mukluks, you know, their fancy go-to meeting mukluks, their dancing mukluks. And they did them on the shoulder trimmings and up in the hood. There's one that I've seen that had trimming like a bib down here, right close here, and then the long bottom one. She said one of her cousins made a parka like that while when she was a young girl, And I saw a copy of a parkie like that down at the Sheldon Jackson Museum. And she's talked about little kids' parkas with trimming on the hood to the shoulders over here in one elders' conference, the different styles that we don't see anymore, you know, because not many people sew that much skin anymore. But it would be good to have her record these while she's still living, you know, and then we have record of them, although we did discuss it in one of our elders' conferences, so it's on tape somewhere. I think there's different definitions to art. The Western people put everything on canvas and put it on the wall, you know. Our people didn't do that. The things of beauty, you know, we were a practical people. There was very little artwork done just to look at it. And so the clothing that they made were made beautiful, you know. It not only looked beautiful, but it also kept you warm. And I think because they're not easy to make, you know, you have to have a knowledge of the styles, because the men's style and the woman's style are different. And in order to sew that many pieces of skin together and the different cuts together and still have a parkie that hangs down well and fits the person is a work of art, you know? Unless some of us learn how to do that pretty soon, that art is going to die away, and we'll just have her old parkas hanging in museums, you know? So we better get on the ball and learn, you know, learn to tan those skins and learn to sew them and learn our own styles.
How do you think that Lena's work has contributed to preserving these inbound sewing methods and the skills?
Ever since she was a young woman, Lena has always enjoyed sewing. She can make any garment. Anything that a man wears, a parka, fur pants, mukluks, mittens, anything, gloves. She can make anything. Anything that a woman wears, out of skins, out of furs, out of anything, she can make. She has always enjoyed sewing. And early in life, she got a reputation of making beautiful things, that her sewing was good, that they hung well, that they fit well, that they lasted long. And so, whenever some people got enough skins together and wanted to have a fancy parkie, they'd ask her to make it, because they knew that she would do a good job and that it would fit them and that it would last long. So consequently, there ended up a lot of parkies in many families of the parkies that Lena made. And because there are so many parkies today, we're not going to lose it as quickly as if there were just one or two, you know? So the more we have, the longer it's going to stay. It's just like if the more people learn to speak Inupiaq, the longer we'll keep it, you know? And the fewer that speak it, the sooner we'll lose it. So I think we just never realized this when we were growing up, or the importance of retaining our own culture and have the responsibility to pass it on to the next generation. See, we have a responsibility to learn it from the previous generation, and then we have a responsibility to pass it on to the next generation. That step was not kept up in previous generations because of the way that we lived. We were punished for using our language, and then in order to get a higher education, we had to leave home, you know. Different circumstances put us in this situation. But now I hope that people are realizing that if we're to retain these things that are important to our own culture, we have to learn them from previous generations and pass them on down to the next generation. Like I said earlier, when I first started working with the elders in 1975, she was one of the people that started working in the land selection committee, talking about the cemetery sites and historical places within the Kotzebue area. And since that time, she has attended all of our elders' conferences, and she's been generous with her knowledge. No matter what topic we ask the elders to discuss, and she knows about it. She has been very generous with her knowledge. And sometimes she'll say, "I don't know about that. You'll have to ask so and so. Maybe he knows, you know." But she's been in the areas that she knows, she's been really generous. And she also really feels that when our kids learn their own culture and the behavior that was expected by the previous generations, and they accept it and start being that way too, we will be good people, all of us. Not just the grown-ups. Like when I was growing up, no matter where we were, no matter what part of town we were, if we were doing things that weren't right, any grown-up would scold us, you know? They corrected us right now. They didn't care whose kids we were. The older generation felt responsible for our proper training, and so they corrected us right now. And not only that, they told our parents of what they did to us down here, you know. And so when we came home, we had to answer to our own parents. So raising children in our day was a community effort. Other grown-ups didn't say, "Oh, that's his parents' job, let them do it." You know, they didn't let kids walk away with anything. They corrected them. And I think we need to have that kind of community responsibility, you know, not just watch kids doing bad things and not wanting to get involved, but feel a community responsibility to those kids that whether they're home or someplace else, they're going to get the same training, you know. It was important to us when we were growing up. Yeah, Lena has really contributed to a lot of what we've done, and not only her, all the elders that have participated. Some of them might not say much, but they contributed, and they supported each other, and they would say, what so-and-so said is true, and I will tell you part of it, you know. And or they will say, I would like to support so-and-so in what she said, because, you know, and then give their reasons why. And all of what they talk about, they just really support each other. And and some of them say, oh, so-and-so